80 countries, in 7 languages, to over a 500 million viewers each week. The World Wrestling Federation, the worldwide leader in sports entertainment.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 5, amazingly, of the Ringside Chat Podcast. I'm Gary Freeland, and with me, as always, is Court Montgomery and Joe Kosvinski. How you guys doing?
What's going on?
What's up, man?
Not a damn thing.
That's the end. Let's end the recording. You'll be done.
Oh, man. Well, I didn't think I'd see you guys back after last episode with talking Halloween Havoc.
Well, a part of me was hoping I didn't come back after Halloween Havoc, and that shit was rough.
And I waited on a roof for a long time, hoping somebody would push me off, and no one ever did, so I'm back.
Well, I was thinking it. Good.
I was saying he just needed to call Hogan. It's just, that's not what the problem.
I was thinking Court wasn't going to show up, and instead we get the Yeti. So,
well, if we did video chat, you would see I have a lot of toilet paper on me right now, so I guess this was all for nothing.
You know they can't see you on a podcast, right?
Look, the Rolling Rock can see me, so shut the fuck up.
And we'll be able to hear you peeing in the empty bottles here, so
I mute the mic, goddammit, okay?
I just totally spit in my drink.
Why would you spit in your drink?
Because I was in mid-sip and Gary was talking about pissing in a beer bottle. He lost me there.
God, this is what we've come to, guys. We're only, what, 2 minutes in? We've gone off the fucking rails already.
We've literally alienated all our listeners anyway, like the last 4 episodes, so it's pretty much, we can do whatever the hell we want now.
Yeah,
well, do we want to go ahead and shit on anybody now while we've got their attention?
Well, the list is long and distinguished, so, I mean, we might as well.
All right, guys. So, are we ready for this shit show that we've got to go through again? We didn't get enough of 1995, which, in my personal opinion, is one of the worst years in wrestling once it became a big modern, the mega that is professional wrestling. We didn't get enough of WCW. We're bringing on WWF today.
Listen, 95 was a great year. It gave us Forrest Gump and Gangster's Paradise. I mean, come on, what more can you ask for?
Yeah, was that in WWF?
No, but...
just my point.
Listen, I have Razor Ramon in 1995, so I'm fucking happy.
I've got Owen Hart, so I can't say much. Well, before we get to 1995 WWF, Joe, is there anything you wanted to bring up on the episode?
Yeah, I wanted to... yesterday, well, of our recording day, yesterday, the 27th of May was the 21st anniversary of Scott Hall jumping the barricade in Nitro and cutting his famous promo in his Canadian tuxedo. So, I know for myself, that was it was a big deal. I know this is a topic that has been talked about to death, but I just wanted to get your guys' opinions and reactions when you first saw this thing and what you thought of it at the time.
No, I think it was a shocker. I mean, that was pre-internet for me, at least. I didn't get any of the newsletters at that point. I was too poor to call the hotline and get all the bullshit news on there. So to see him come out through the crowd and be like, holy shit, Razor Ramon's on WCW, what the hell is he doing there? And then to cut his promo was a big deal. And I'm not as big a Razor Ramon fan as Joey, because I think that's impossible for anyone to attain. But, I mean, to me, that was a huge star and a huge loss for the WWF at the time.
Yeah, losing both Razor and Diesel back-to-back like that hurt him a lot. I remember as a kid, it was just awesome. You know, seeing him show up and then however many weeks later seeing Diesel show up or, you know, Hall and Nash. It was awesome to see. And I think that they did a really good job of bringing them in like it was a big invasion. You know, of course, there's always been the stories of WWF sending them a cease and desist letter and whatever, but they did a really good job of making it look like Vince was invading the competition.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, you know, at the time I did it, I think what most people did at the time, you know, switching back and forth between Raw and Nitro. And, you know, I would tend to stick on Raw more than Nitro, but for whatever reason, I was able to catch it at the right time. And it really, I don't know, it had a real big impact on me as a fan because I was so disappointed we didn't get the WrestleMania 12 matchup with Goldust and Razor. And that really upset me. And then, you know, you don't see him on TV, you don't hear nothing, obviously, unless you're reading stuff. So, like, you know, I'm like, well, what the hell happened to him? And then to see him on there, I was just like, wow, now I actually have a reason to watch Nitro and Raw. And I didn't know, like, all the legal stuff, so I was just curious on what's he going to be. And is he going to be Razor, or is he going to be something else, or whatever. So it definitely made me start watching WCW a lot more. I'll give it that. To piggyback on what I just said, one thing also, too, that I think is pretty important is that as a fan, though, you all of a sudden started having, like, these... this kind of, like, internal thing, like, well, what type of excitement, like, what type of, like, surprise are we going to see on Nitro, or even on Raw, because then this really started the floodgates of wrestlers leaving. And I think that in itself also definitely made those shows more exciting, depending on how their appearances and their characters were handled down the road. But I definitely think that it made for a better show.
I think it, I don't necessarily know if it started the floodgates, because as we'll get into it once we have our guest on here, there was a lot of people that had left, and there was a lot of people that were rumored to have left, were going to leave. Bigger names that I hadn't heard of until I started looking into it. But I think this was because they were essentially being Razor Ramon, and then eventually when Nash came in, Diesel. That was, they were stealing that intellectual property, and I think that was the first, like, shot across the bow that, okay, we're serious about putting you out of business.
And then they come up, you know, just, I'm not sure how quick it was fairly quick with the fake Razor and Diesel. You know, yeah. They went ahead and made it a point to say, hey, you know, we have Razor and Diesel, you have the guys that used to play them, but we have the characters.
And that shit works in Mexico. Where they have the fucking hoods that they can wear. Okay, you can keep the, and kind of switch from generation to generation to keep the same character. But that was so ridiculous that they thought that was ever going to get over. And poor Kane, getting stuck in another horrid-ass gimmick after being a dentist. Or was that was after the dentist, right?
Yeah, that was after.
It was. Yeah.
Well, that was the other thing for me when they came out with the fake Razor and fake Diesel. Like I at the time, at that point when they were coming out, like I didn't have Nitro on, and I was thinking, oh man, that was quick. Is he already back again? And then as soon as they brought him out, I was like, really? And then you tie poor JR to this fucking sinking ship of a gimmick.
Yeah, heel JR, the most likable announcer ever. Let's try to turn him heel.
This is dumb. JR also got the shit in the stick a lot in WWF for multiple different reasons. On air and off air.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, let's move on to the shit show that is WWF 1995.
Woohoo!
No one wants to. Gary, that's okay, yeah, I'm there. Okay, you want to go ahead and bring in our guest?
Yeah, I can do that. So, we're going to do this periodically. We're over at Facebook, our ringside chat group. We're going to bring some people on here every once in a while, and they're going to select a topic for us to talk about. And our first is one of our most avid listeners, is Stan Sharp. So it's all his fault that we're going to talk about 1995 WWF, probably the worst year in wrestling history. So without further ado, Stan, welcome to the show.
You don't know who I am, but now you know why I'm here.
He brought it around. Jesus.
Now that's a smooth fucking segue.
Stan's coming for my job already. He's been on here 15 seconds. He's already doing a better job, so.
So, Stan.
Yes.
What made you pick the topic of 1995 WWF?
Because I'm a glutton for punishment. No, seriously, really, if...
He listens to this show, so yeah.
Well, you know, really, I thought that if you guys already tackled probably one of the worst pay-per-views with, you know, Hogan and the Big Show and Monster Trucks and Heenan not having any of freaking Bischoff's crap and the, Charmin Pillsbury Dome monster coming in to hump Hogan, and all other stuff, but thing is, like, I thought we'd take a look on the other side of this broken antique mirror and see how bad it was at comparison. I mean, there was some bad characters. I mean, freaking, yeah, Mantor and then, you know, Man of War and everything and other various characters from the Animal Kingdom. But there was also good talent there. Like you see, you still got Owen, you still had Barrett, you had Bulldog, Michaels was there, you know, Sean, you know, Diesel and Razor was there for most time. So they're still good, but it was like you had to sift through the crap just to get to the diamonds.
Yeah, I'm with you, because, I mean, I can talk about how bad a lot of this stuff was. But, I mean, I know we talked about in the first episode how Gary went to SummerSlam 95. And, you know, you look at the card, and it's pretty much shit, but there's, like, two pretty good matches. And I feel like that right there just explained WWF 95 as a whole. It's a lot of shit. There's a couple of good things in there.
Exactly. And there's other things that was in there that is, like, you look back in hindsight and think, why did they do this? But then, like, it worked later. Mabel, Viscera, for example, you know, his main event push and the injuring Diesel. But then, flash forward like 10, 12 years later, and he's a great heel in the ECW remake.
Right. I mean, that happens to a lot of people, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves.
Oh, I'm trying not to.
Let's start from the very beginning. Does anybody have any notes starting off? I've got Royal Rumble pulled up now, looking at the results.
I actually have some notes on 94, what kind of led up to where they're at, some of the things that were going on. They were trying to build Diesel up as a champion, new face of the company. It was failing miserably. Crowds were down. They had just lost Randy Savage to WCW. Was really giving WWF the perception that they were trying to cheap out, essentially. And they had been declining for a while. Since about 92, they had a slow decline, but it really picked up in 95 because Savage, essentially, and eventually, and I think Hogan went even before him, those are their two top names. And they're going to WCW, so it lended WCW a lot of credibility that they're the show to watch, even though you could argue Hogan was probably past his prime, or at the end of his prime, and Savage is always good, but, I mean, they weren't in the middle of their prime years. However, you still had guys like Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, but they weren't names at that point. So it was that transition, those growing pains that were causing them a lot of grief. Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, I didn't experience this firsthand. I didn't come into watching wrestling until around November, December of 95, leading into 96's Royal Rumble. But just going back and watching, especially around 94, one of the things that really caught my eye is you know, you ride the Hogan train for as long as they did, and even Savage, and then you do the Warrior, and then you transition into Flair, and then you finally put the belt on Bret and Yoko. It blows my mind that, you know, Vince doesn't see, like, well, you know, we should probably get some guys ready, because eventually the fans are going to grow tired of Hogan, which they already were. They're going to start growing tired of Savage, which never did, but you would think that he would be smart enough to realize this. And I'm just wondering if maybe he was just like, had his head up his ass, or just thinking that he could make anybody like the next Hogan, or what it was. But watching at it in the 93, 94, it's just like, you have great talent. Why aren't you just putting the whole machine behind him instead of just what you got?
And here's the thing, it could have been a lot worse. And this is something new for me, as I was kind of researching for the show. I don't know if you guys know, they have that, like, where their contracts automatically renew. The Titan contracts, the WWF contracts. A lot of the wrestlers didn't even realize that was the case. There was guys like Ted DiBiase, Bret Hart, Jake the Snake Roberts, in that early 90s period, that didn't realize that, and had huge money offers to go to WCW. So the whole landscape could have been completely different with guys like the Million Dollar Man and Bret Hart, who was a huge part of this new generation era, especially in 95, 96, that could have been in WCW. And God knows where their careers would have went, and God knows what would have happened to WWF.
That's wild.
Yeah, especially
Bret. I never knew that. Yeah,
well, one thing I remember listening on a different podcast was, and this right up to like, back in, I think it was 91, 92 when it happened. The whole exchange between the Intercontinental title from Hart to Mountie, the Piper to back to Hart, was that there was, the Hart was sick and he was going to drop it, but there was also talk that Hart was going to leave and go, he was offered to go to WCW. And their big WCW did this whole thing. It was like, we got this big announcement. It was somebody who's coming over. And then Hart renewed and stayed with Vince. And so WCW quickly changed their plan. And their big reveal was Jesse Ventura.
Mm-hmm.
And that was originally supposed to be Hart.
Yep.
That's awesome. But I didn't know that either.
Just imagine how much would have changed. Would Steve Austin be Steve Austin without Bret Hart? Because really, before Vince, Bret was his main foil. Before he was even Stone Cold and he was kind of developing that character, all his shit-talk promos, all the things that got him the popularity up to that WrestleMania 13 main event, was talking about Bret Hart and how he's going to beat Bret Hart's ass and all these other things. And if Bret's not there, who is that guy? I don't know if there is one.
I almost feel like that he probably would have eventually gotten over, but it probably would have taken a longer time. And at that point, how much of a hole have you dug yourself in if you're the WWE or F going up against WCW? So maybe instead of, you know, 97, 98, Austin, you're probably looking at maybe 99? And by then...
Okay, long that terms, I'm sorry if I cut you off.
Oh, no, you're fine.
If it did that and it didn't have the foil like Bret and to a lesser extent Owen because of the neck injury, if he didn't have them, I think his more popularity wouldn't have grown as fast as it did, or like fast as The Rock did. It would probably be almost as fast as Hunter's. And it would take about 5 or 6 years. So you'll look at like 2000, maybe 01.
That's possible. I mean, think about it. Let's say Bret did move. Does that mean in 93, Lex would have still got that huge push because there was no Bret to fuck that up for him? I'm not saying Bret did it purposely.
He probably would have gone over Yoko.
I mean, that's...
Good.
I was going to say, you're probably looking at that. And at that point, how much of a bigger run are you going to give him? And are you going to have that fuck you of a finish with Yoko and Hogan at WrestleMania 9.
And is WWF even around by 98, 99? There's a lot of stories on the Austin rise to power and how Tyson and all those things kind of played a part in that. Do you even have the money to bring Mike Tyson in? Is Steve even ready for that big push at WrestleMania 14 where he wins the title? Who takes his place if he's not there? Does Shawn keep the title? Do you put Undertaker in that spot? They could have been out of business. They were basically running on fumes at that point, and if Austin doesn't catch on at the time that he catches on, they may not even exist. And then you're talking about guys like The Rock. Who's The Rock faced? I mean, really, his main feud, what kind of built him up, was Austin. Even at the Intercontinental title level. That was his big feud was with Stone Cold Steve Austin. That's what he kind of became known for, other than the shit-talking promos. Well, so a lot of things based off of one guy could have spiraled this company completely out of control.
Well, refresh my memory, is had Austin already started shit-talking before King of the Ring 96?
Yes.
Okay. Because I was gonna...
It was about April, I think, 96, because he lost that match with Savio Vega at Mania 12. Was it 12 at 96?
Yeah.
Lost at 12, so Ted's out. So there's no more ringmaster. Shows his head bald, he comes out. So it's about April, May. You know, he starts doing this. June or July is King of the Ring, and the rest is history.
Well, because my point is, like, if he's not already talking about Bret Hart and... before King of the Ring 96. And he's already... And then he does the thing with Jake at King of the Ring. What a big... You know, like... Bret's gone. You have this big old, like... hole. Where he's pretty much could be dead, essentially. His character. Because there's nothing else to do. So yeah, do you hotshot? I mean, do you hotshot like say like a Sid Vicious, Justice or Vicious or whatever? Bring him in to help him out or the Undertaker or something. You gotta do something. And it's just crazy to think that like Gary's mentioned it, how pivotal Bret Hart really is to this company when Vince has made all this fanfare about Lex Luger.
I think it's one of those fun things to kind of. Talk about. I mean, you could almost do a whole episode on that. We had talked about doing possibly some fantasy booking in the future for this. What if Bret Hart goes to WCW? Not only what does he do there, does he ever reach the stardom that he reached? I don't think so, personally. And what happens to the WWF without Bret Hart? How many people does that impact?
Well, in 96, there was rumors that Bret was going to be the third man. Not Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another cog in the system. And it brings up another thing is, I got to thinking about this earlier today at work, too. You know, not to take about a step ahead, and we're starting at the Rumble. You know, Shawn wins the Rumble, goes to fight Diesel at Mania 11. What if Michaels wins the belt at Mania 11 from Diesel at that time? So there's not that animosity it's been building, but it doesn't really come to a head in 96. So there's not that animosity that's really building between Shawn and Bret from WrestleMania 12. Would we still have the boiling point that is, you know, Survivor Series 97? Could Bret still been in the company, say, 99 fighting Kurt Angle?
And how different does the NWO look with Bret Hart there instead of Hulk Hogan? I don't think that angle, and I love Bret Hart, I don't think that angle is nearly as impactful with Bret Hart in that role as it is Hulk Hogan turning heel.
No.
I don't think that angle is nearly as impactful with anyone else, because I've heard too that it was almost Sting was going to be the third man. You know, I mean, you put anybody else in that role besides Hulk Hogan, because even though everybody was tired of Hogan's shit by that point, and he was getting booed all over the place, it was still a shock that he turned. So, without Hogan, I don't think the NWO would have been at least as successful. I'm not saying they wouldn't have been either way, but I don't think it would have had the impact that it ended up having.
It also is well overdue that he needed to turn heel. last time he was healed, like, what, 81, 82?
Yeah, it was around Memphis and stuff. And even the AWA.
And that was really before he was even known nationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was like right before Thunder Lips.
Right. So a lot of people didn't know Hogan as a heel. I sure as hell didn't as a kid.
No.
And that's something like the internet's really taped. I mean, I really mentioned it before. I forget where it was, but I mentioned it. The internet is a double-edged sword to wrestling in general. There's a good and there's a bad to it. There's the good, you get to see all the independent federations that don't have the financial means to get out there. But then the bad is then you start seeing more and more and more and more stuff coming out, and then it starts getting spoiled easier. And so it's kind of like, not like it was in the 90s when you could flip on and you could see, you know, holy crap, Hogan just turned on, turned and made the NWO.
You know what's funny though? Is we're going to be talking about Royal Rumble 95, and one of the entrants into Royal Rumble 95 was Steve Dahl, or Steve Dunn, and he was one of the ones in the match that Scott Hall jumped the barricade on. Look at that.
That's awesome. I didn't know that.
There you go.
This is when he was on the heavily well done.
Well done, yeah.
Sir, don't you ever confuse the heavenly bodies with well done ever again.
I shouldn't have confused them. Freaking, not Tom, yeah, Tom Pritchard. That's why I got my Sire Desire gimmick thing from, was from the Doctor Desire.
Okay, well, that's awesome. But yeah, no, you're on thin ice, sir. Thin ice.
So what else do you have for 94, Gary?
Yeah, nothing real big other than that. I mean, they were kind of still reeling from the loss of Savage, even though they sort of forced him out. But yeah, that was really the big piece that I thought was by far the most interesting. And I mean, to kind of touch on that, DiBiase was also mentioned in there. Does he go back to his old gimmick prior to the WWF? Does he ever get hurt? Maybe his career's extended in WCW? I mean, there's a lot of possibilities with him going there. And I still feel like he had a lot left in the tank in 95. So I think he would have been a nice piece for them. I don't know if he would have been a main event player per se, but he would have definitely been a huge deal in my eyes as 11-year-old me watching this, that the Million Dollar Man's now in WCW.
He might have actually got his deserving world championship.
He may have.
I mean, look at the wonders they did for Rude.
That's true. Yeah, WWE, it was weird. I mean, and I understand the booking philosophy behind it because of Hogan and wanting to ride that wave as long as you can. You had the biggest star in the history of the business at that point. But to me, and I even felt this way at the time, it would make more sense for him to chase than to him just destroy the monster of the week like they would do. But I think that's just a fundamental philosophy in booking, which kind of brings me to my next point. In 95, there was some friction between Vince and Pat Patterson behind the scenes. A lot of what was going on with Diesel and the poor numbers at the houses were kind of blamed on Pat Patterson and his booking. So they brought Jim Ross in at this point for this role, to kind of be Vince's assistant, which I found it interesting. And in the Observer, they were bringing Ross in, and this is hilarious thinking back on it now, knowing that what happened in 1995, that they were going to book the WWF in a more sport-oriented Japanese style, kind of like New Japan is today, where wins and losses really mean something, not so many characters, really focus on the wrestling. And looking back on that now, that's just completely ridiculous, considering all the ridiculous characters that were introduced in 1995.
Yeah, that's That's something, though, that I just can't imagine Vince wanting to go from The Rock and wrestling and the stuff there and then heading into this and going, well, let's make it more sports-oriented, pal. Wow, really? You could have... I get that you wanted this to separate yourself in the 80s, but by now you only have two groups outside of Memphis, or two companies outside of Memphis. How much, I mean, I guess, that. But I just, yeah, you didn't have, I don't think they had the characters or the guys, they had the guys there that could do it, but maybe not, I don't know, the gimmick's just too much.
I think it would have been such a departure from what they had been doing that I think and as much as I would have loved to see more sports-oriented wrestling, I think that's when it's most effective. And I do think they had some of the talent there to do it. I think it would have been such a shock for the fan base that you would have had more people drive to WCW. Because WCW, for years, in predecessors, the NWA era, that's what they focused on, but they were kind of shifting the other direction. They were going more of the cartoony character, Dungeon of Doom, Hulk Hogan kills the Monster of the Month, and those type of angles, and their numbers were going up. The critical appeal of their product shot way down, and as I was going through some of Meltzer's dirt sheets, the approval rating was really low on some of the WCW shows. But they were doing some of their biggest business ever.
That's why I really think that the Ross coming in as the assistant and them going towards a Japanese style, that had to have been either someone fed Meltzer the wrong info on purpose, or someone just didn't know what the fuck they were talking about. Because in my heart, I don't feel like Vince McMahon would have ever given a fuck about something like that. Like, he has his idea of what he wants wrestling to be. He wants it to be entertainment. He wants it to be this. He wants it to be that. I don't see Vince ever, like, watching All Japan Wrestling back in 95 and be like, that's what I want my show to be. Like, no, he's looking for the next Hogan. He's looking for the next character. So that's why I just don't think, I mean, unless that was maybe Ross trying to push it to be like that, I don't think Vince ever was like, yeah, we should do that. It just doesn't seem his style, you know?
And that's why Ross has probably been fired a half dozen times since he's been in the company.
Exactly.
Well, what strikes me as funny is you have guys trying out in the WWF in 95, guys like Chris Benoit and a few others. If that's the style they were going to go, why not pick those guys up that already know how to work that style?
They had one person that in 95 that could work that style, and I loved his in-ring work, but, you know, he didn't get very far. Hakushi, you know, Jinsei Sakai. Guy was great.
Oh, dude, Shinzaki was awesome, man. I loved Hakushi. It is a shame that he didn't get any further than he did in the Fed. But I think that was just an experiment, you know. I could think of a list of people that were in Japan in 95 that would have done amazing in America. Maybe not necessarily WWF because they had a certain idea of what they wanted, but holy shit. Huh?
Kobashi.
Yes. Well, Kobashi did have the look Vince wanted.
Yeah, they had, like you said, they had people over there they could have brought in. I mean, I don't know how big of a gap it was at that time, but Vader was a free agent in part of 95.
I'm curious, though. You have, like Stan said, you have Hakushi. You have people like Sean Waltman, you know, Bret Hart, even Owen Hart, you know, that can work at style and stuff. What would have a Chris Benoit look like in 95 WWF had he actually gotten a contract after his tryout? I mean, does he succeed? Or is he just going to be a failure and then have to go back to Japan or go to ECW or something like that? Because I would think that with those guys, he would probably, you know, depending on how they booked him, I think he'd be kick-ass.
Dude, Benoit.
I think he'd have the Mr. Perfect push, kind of.
Benoit could have easily been an Intercontinental Champion had they kept him. I mean, he had a great style. He had the Stampede connection, which would have easily gotten him over because Brett's stamp of approval meant everything in 95. I mean, can you imagine the matches he could have had with somebody like Michaels? You know, 1-2-3 Kid at the time. It would have been awesome.
You know, like I said, you know, I think you get that perfect push. You get build up. You get that Intercontinental title. You even challenge for the world title. You know, maybe he'd be successful. Who knows? But at the same time, maybe he brings in his buddies and seeing, hey, you know, he's doing good. So maybe we bring in Malenko. Maybe we bring in Guerrero.
Jericho,
yes. Imagine Jericho getting a Jericho. If they did that and they jumpstart Jericho before he came in 99, I don't think The Rock would have had a chance to even get off the ground as the great trash talker, because I think Jericho would have overtaken him before he started.
I agree. I just think there's so many great matchups there if you bring some of those guys in. They may have not had the complete roster that they needed to go that route, if that was the case. But, I mean, you already had a pretty decent base with the Harts and Shawn and Razor and all those guys in 95 that could work a harder style. But, yeah, bringing in guys like Guerrero and Jericho and Benoit and Malenko.
Storm.
So many guys. They could have raided ECW then. I mean, that was really their peak year was 95, 96. And they had a ton of talent there. You imagine a Chris Benoit, Owen Hart match, or a Chris Jericho, Owen Hart match.
And don't make me come back and play my game.
Those are all matchups I would have killed to see, and it would have completely reinvented WWF for that time. And it would have been really interesting to see once you started adding guys like Vader, like Austin, like Pillman, how they would have fit in to that kind of new age WWE style, I guess.
It's kind of like a mixture. You get this Japanese, hardworking, mat style, kind of strong style wrestling, like the Vader, like Benoit, Owen, you know, that kind of stuff we were talking about. You mix in people like Austin, like Hunter, like Pillman. So you get the best of both worlds right there. What you got is pretty much a dream roster of the 90s, which will have way more talent than what WCW was having, sans Macho and Flair being their top talent.
They would have essentially switched roles. WCW for years was the worker promotion. That's where all the guys that worked went, and the character promotion was WWF. And it would have been really weird to see them flip roles in that way, but I think it could have worked. Hell would it be Bob Sparkplug Holly or the Minotaur or Avatar and Shinobi and all the other bullshit characters that they had in 95?
They would probably get drafted. They probably would have got drafted in with WCW with Glacier, and as much as I like Kang and Mortis.
Yeah.
I almost feel like, though, you bring in those guys, and, I mean, some of them, height-wise, probably aren't what Vince is wanting, but still, I think you bring those in, I looking at 95, it definitely holds true, you've now boosted your Intercontinental title, like, group, more so than what you have for the heavyweight guys. Because I feel like...
Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I feel like the heavyweight guys, you just have like 2, 3, maybe 4 at the most. The rest, you have, you know, it's stacked. And I think you bring those guys in, I almost feel like the WWF title was like second fiddle, more so than it already was at that point.
Well, you also got to remember the other talent they had in there too, you know. They do this, and some of these people that weren't in the Intercontinental Division get boosted up. If Owen maybe gets a world title shot. You know, Razor gets back into the world title picture instead of just one time in, like, what, 93? You know, you get these people boosted up. You, Jarrett's in the mid-car, in the Stone Intercontinental. So you got all these people feuding around, but then you also got these guys just established going up there and, you know, intermixing together, and you got some amazing cards.
And this is fresh off the heels of the steroid trials.
Yes.
They were clearly going for guys that were smaller. So you could have, I mean, if they really wanted to reinvent the wheel, this would have been the time to do it. And you could have gone smaller and it could have still been legitimate. Because anytime you talk to wrestling fans, it's always those guys that you go back to.
Considering the fact that, like, the two biggest people that they had on the roster that was juicing, or more likely juicing, was Bulldog and Luger.
Yeah.
I think one thing that really hurt WWF in 95, like, they were trying their best to get Diesel over. And I think the reason that the heavyweight title scene suffered so bad is because they were trying to give him the Hogan treatment. They just had Diesel kind of killing off guys. You know, guys like Sid, guys like Mabel. And it just didn't work. People weren't getting behind Diesel. Well, you know, the fans liked him, but they didn't believe him. Like, yeah, he was a big, tall guy. They didn't believe it like they did back with Hogan, that he was just beating up all these guys. The other thing, too, is that WWF was really bad for, they were the opposite of guys like the AWA, guys like Crockett, WCW, where the babyface champion defeating all the heels was the New York way, the WWF way. The Southern Midwest way was for the babyface to be chasing. So the times were changing and the fans were tired of the heroes always conquering. Sometimes your heroes have to fail before they can conquer, and I don't think WWF had quite caught on to that concept yet.
Well, one thing I also...
Go ahead, Gary. No, Gary, go ahead.
I also think Diesel didn't have credible opponents to do the Hogan treatment with. Not to say that Bret Hart's not a credible opponent and they had a hell of a match at the Rumble, but he didn't have those monsters to slay. Like they set up for Taker, like they set up for Hogan, like they ended up setting up for Austin and The Rock and all the top guys. He didn't really have that. So, and they didn't let him talk. He's probably one of the better talkers. That's definitely his best trait. And really is what got him over in WCW. They didn't really let him talk. They stuck him in a gimmick that I personally didn't feel fit his personality. He's more of a natural heel. Any interview you hear him talk, anytime he's on the air, he just has that air about him that you want to smack him, but he's too big to do anything to. I personally felt like they had, and it kind of goes in hand with what's going on with Roman Reigns right now, a guy that they could have built a heel monster around. He could have been that heel guy that they kind of did with Yokozuna a year or two before, where he held the title for a year and just ran through all the superstars, all the baby faces. And I know that's not the WWF way at the time, but that, again, they were trying to change their image based off the steroid trials. That would have been a hell of a way to do it.
Well, to me, and you guys would probably be able to speak on this a lot more than I would, because you guys remember this firsthand. How much of it, though, on Diesel's part, is fans bitching that you keep constantly taking this belt off of Bret Hart? And I get it. You want him, you want to take it off of him and build these great angles and then give it back to him and stuff. But how much stopping and starting do you have with Bret Hart at this time? The fans are finally, like, throwing their hands up, like, listen, you keep giving us either Lex Luger, Yokozuna, Hogan, Diesel, whatever. We just want Bret as champion. We just want, you know, maybe not a San Martino run, but we want something big. And, you know, looking at it, it looks like to me that some of these fans are just like, no, I want Bret. You keep giving me Diesel or whatever. Just give me fucking Bret for, you know, a year or 6 months or longer, you know, rather than this.
I think what hurt Bret a lot was he just was not the strongest talker on earth. Bret had some pretty lengthy runs with the title. I think his first title run was 9 or 10 months. I mean, that was pretty lengthy for the time, even. Before he got the screw job finish with Yoko at 9. I don't recall how he lost it the second time. But I think they were never really behind him.
I think it was against Backlund. That's what it was.
And did Backlund lost in 45 seconds to Diesel?
8 seconds.
Oh, well.
Yeah, because I remember that. That was one of the very few things I remember vividly about 95 was watching, I think it was All American Wrestling, and they were showing the match he had with Diesel at the Garden where Diesel basically just hits a jackknife powerbomb and pins him in 8 seconds, and they just, like, kept replaying that over and over again. And I thought it was so cool at the time that, you know, they had a title change at a house show, which was never heard of at that point, and that they had it in such dominant fashion.
It'd have been 45 seconds if he'd done the hair flip.
Yeah. But it...
And that brings back to your point, Gary, about Brett having long reigns. He wins the belt at Mania 10, and then doesn't lose it until Survivor Series that year. So that's from March until November. That's most of the year.
Yeah.
But it's not memorable because he didn't have good opponents, I don't think. I mean, yeah, he did have a great match, a long match with Owen at SummerSlam, but the fans weren't used to big, long storytelling feuds, at least in WWF. They were used to a lot of hotshot angles. Every couple of months, somebody different. Whereas in the WCW, NWA at the time, you know, get away with a year-long feud, and those kind of fans were used to that.
And I think the other part of it was, his first two title reigns, the first one was against Flair, he beat him clean, but it wasn't even on television. It was on, like, a Coliseum home video release, like at a house show in Canada. So it wasn't even on TV where people could actually see him beating the legend Ric Flair. So that, to me, took a lot of steam out of him winning that title. And then the second time when he beat Yokozuna at WrestleMania 10, it was like a fluke. I think Yoko tripped on the rope trying to do his bonsai drop, and then he pinned him, and that was it.
He fell backwards. It's exactly how Austin beat him at, like, was SummerSlam 96 or something?
Yeah. So, to me, that does not help your babyface champion when you give him, like, either you don't show the legitimate victory, or you give him, like, this weird, wonky finish, and that's how he won the title. Especially when you're trying to build him as a legit guy, a legit wrestler, the excellence of execution, and you have him winning basically on a banana peel slip, to me, takes a lot of steam out of his title run and his legitimacy.
It doesn't make him look strong.
No, not at all.
Well, I'll go out and say it. This is probably be one of several Razor Ramon, love fest sessions that I'll have, but I'm surprised that they didn't go back to that well, because they did it in 93 at the Royal Rumble with him and Brett. You know, why doesn't, I mean, I know he's a babyface and stuff, but I know Vince doesn't believe in babyface versus babyface, but still, I still feel like that there are still enough pieces there in 95, whether it's Razor, People Laugh, Jeff Jarrett, British Bulldog, guys like that you could probably plug in to help get Brett along. But it's just like, I don't know if it's because Vince doesn't see it like that or what it is.
Was he having his substance abuse problems at that point?
I don't believe so, because, I mean, he had the Intercontinental title heading into Royal Rumble 95. I mean, I know he drops it, but, I mean, he would eventually end up getting it back.
Yeah, then I don't really have an idea. That would really be my only idea why he didn't get a shot. He was his own worst enemy, because he really had everything that Vince wanted. He was a hell of a talker. He was a good worker. He had an awesome gimmick. He was over with the crowd. He's a big guy. Good body. What I didn't really understand what else he needed, but he always seemed like he struggled with getting out of that Intercontinental title division for whatever reason, and he basically checked all the boxes that you think Vince would want.
I'm thinking it was probably, I would have to be substance abuse, other than that. I mean, he wasn't a guy that didn't, he didn't no show. He didn't, you know, hold him up for money or anything like that. I mean, even in 96, you know, he told Vince, you know, you pay me this, I'll stay. And that was it.
Well, but I don't know if that was what it was or not, Joe, only because you think about by the time 96 rolls around, who's your champion? Shawn Michaels, who was had a very storied, huge substance abuse problem at the time, no showing events, has to get the title stripped from him because of this, this, and that. Honestly, I think it's one of those kind of situations where he was just kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time. He sees somebody like Diesel, and he's like, oh, man, that's a huge guy. Let me push him. And then he already, you know, Brett was already kind of his guy by that point. He's like, well, we got to make sure we give Brett his stuff. I really think it was just happened that way. Some guys kind of accidentally get stuck in that way. You brought up Jeff Jarrett, too. Jeff Jarrett was amazing. And he should have had at least, like, kind of like, trying to think of a good example here. We talked about Carl Ouellette on episode 2, and he even had title shots. You can have just these workhorse-style matches just to get your babyface champion over. I don't know. I don't know what the thought process was there. Maybe it was just they were trying to figure out what was going wrong, and they could try to fix it. Maybe that's why, you know, because the Diesel experiment only lasted less than a year, if I'm not mistaken. I think from her turned babyface at SummerSlam 94, and wasn't it SummerSlam 95 when he wrestled Brett and he turned back heel?
SummerSlam 95, he wrestled King Mabel.
No,
it was Survivor Series.
Survivor Series.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that was a year. And, you know, you look at them now, and they're not going to backtrack from their ideas. They're not, no, we're going to stick to it. Then they were desperate to try to figure out how to beat the competition, how to get the fans behind them. So they were, that's why it was a lot of stop and go, I think. They're like, oh, well, this isn't working, let's change it. Instead of letting things marinate and letting them try to get over. The people weren't understanding it at the time. I just think Razor was wrong place, wrong time. He should have been WWF champion. Easily, probably could have been the face of the company had they given him a shot.
Well, I think too with Razor, you know, he's not a politician. I mean, you listen to interviews and stuff, like, he sees, you know, things in guys like Sean Waltman or the Hardys, and, you know, he'll politic for that, but other than that, he doesn't care. Whereas I think Sean and Nash, to a certain extent, even when he gets into WCW, they're the ones that will go out there and beat that war drum about being the top guy. And I think that, in a way, kind of hurts him. And you see with guys even now that aren't real big politicians for themselves, you know, they kind of get passed by in a way, but, you know, it is a shame. But I agree with Jeff Jarrett. I mean, and you look, I mean, I'm surprised Luger didn't get another heel turn here. You know, he'd have been another guy. Or Bam Bam Bigelow. I'm a big Bam Bam Bigelow fan, too. He's there.
Bigelow had a great match with Hart at King of the Ring 93.
Absolutely.
It's like, right, okay, it's like you got the money right there. We got you the proof. You know, going along with the 95 thing, you know, this would have been a great time to show Ted, hey, I could still be an asset for you. Let me get that world title and bring you to the $1 million corporation. There you go. As Ted is his talker, and you're good.
Yeah, it would have made sense.
I just think that there was a lot of could have and should have been, but a lot of this is where the politicians started happening, like you guys mentioned. Another thing I remember reading or hearing or so was that Vince was done with Hall by 96, but he saw more in Nash, and he wanted Nash to stay. Now, I don't know how much of that is true, though.
It makes sense, and I've heard the same thing listening to podcasts and shoot interviews and stuff, that
it could be possible. I mean, I know Nash isn't the type to get busted for drugs, and he's more of a company man. I mean, it's very possible. I mean, history is all, it has already has played itself out where, you know, Scott has, I think the highest he's gotten is the U.S. title or whatever in WCW. So, I mean, he's never won the big one. And he's, to me, he's only, I think, had one world heavyweight match in WWF for the title.
He had like one or two in WCW. And then you look even further back before his Razor stuff, he was actually, Gagne wanted to put the AWA title on him. And he turned it down.
I almost wonder if he falls in that category of doesn't need a title. There's a lot of guys like that. Jake Roberts comes to mind. DiBiase comes to mind. Piper comes to mind.
Yeah.
Did he really need a championship to be over? Because he was always over. That was never a problem with him. Even in WCW when he was really just drunk on the air, essentially, he was still over with the crowd. He'd come out and say, hey, yo, and the roof would blow off the building.
To me, I think he does kind of fall into that category because you're right. The fans gravitated towards him. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
His picture got a pop during that San Francisco 49ers match with Jared and Booker.
Yeah, I've been a mark for him for years, and, you know, I just think that, much like Piper, you know, he had it. He had the things that you needed to be the top guy, and you're right, you don't need to put a belt on him. I mean, to me, he is my defining Intercontinental Champion. When, you know, people will look at Honky Tonk Man or Savage when he held the belt or whatever. No, to me, Razor Ramon made that belt for me at that time. Because in an era of 90, especially in 95, you have gimmicks like Mantar, Quang, whatever. You had Razor Ramon, even though he's doing a gimmick from the 80s, he was, to me, top three workers in that company.
Yeah, I don't think there's any arguing that. I think any company he ever worked for, he was probably top two, three, four workers. He just had it. He had all boxes checked, but for whatever reason, he just never got over the hump. We kind of been talking a lot about what ifs with 95, but let's talk about what actually happened. What did they do? We can waste another 3 hours on what they did bad. What did they actually do good in 95? What were some things that stick out in your mind about that were positive about 1995?
Well, as much as I hated the actual match itself, the finish to the 95 Royal Rumble was sweet. You let both guys at number one and number two go the distance. Now, who the fuck remembers who else was in that match? But who cares? That may, honestly, as much as I like to shit on 95, that may have been booking genius. Maybe, you know, let's just think kind of positive here for a second. You don't want to remember the middle. You want to remember the fact that Bulldog and Michaels went the whole way. And you have the iconic moment, which from what I've heard from multiple shoot interviews, it was a legit fuck-up of Michaels. But you have an iconic moment where the 1 foot touches the ground, but it doesn't count. You know, he sneaks back in, eliminates Bulldog. That was a sweet finish. Unfortunately, you know, that they had to be overshadowed. Sean got that big first main event, but he didn't get the main event. It was actually Bam Bam and LT, which, from a marketing standpoint, publicity, that was fucking smart to bring in, you know, Lawrence Taylor. And the match, honestly, wasn't even as bad as you would think it would have been.
Nope.
But the greatest thing about that match that ever happened was Mongo.
That's true, he was in that.
Never mind that shit, here comes Mongo!
Exactly.
Listen, you talk about 95 and, like, nobody cares about, you know, outside of Sean and the Bulldog. Listen, I'll admit, I didn't watch it live at the time, but going back and watching it now, I marked out at number 27 when Dick Murdoch came in.
She's a name you wouldn't expect around 95.
Okay, well, yeah, that was awesome. I give you that. But what I mean is, like, in 95, what the fuck was Dick Murdoch doing?
No, nothing. No, I get it. I was just, looking at the list now of all 30 entrants into that Royal Rumble. I mean, yeah, it really shows how thin of a roster they had at that time, given that you have both Smoking Guns, you have both Bushwhackers, you have both teams of guys of Well Done. Then you got, you know, guys like Rick Martel or Doink, or, you know, both Heavenly Bodies, and even got Luger in there with, you know, guys that would end up becoming a staple in 96, 97 with Godwin and the Dumpster.
I actually have some notes on why Murdoch was there. They had, and I mean, take this with a grain of salt, it's coming from the sheets, but they actually had plans for him to kind of have him in that legend face role that, like, Caro Aguayo at the time was doing in Mexico. What is it?
It's Beer 30.
Okay. So they had some plans for him to kind of be that legendary face to kind of build up some heels. And his run was supposed to be about a year long, from what I have in my notes.
That would be interesting.
Do we know why it didn't last?
From what I've read and researched, he just was not in good health at that time.
No, because he died.
Was it in?
He died the following year.
Yeah, so I'm thinking he probably didn't pass a physical, or he just wasn't, like, cutting the mustard health-wise in the ring, and it was probably just too big of a liability. But, yeah, and he did die a year later, so it's another what-if scenario. What if he was healthier, or how would that have looked, and what could he have done to help build up some of the heels in the company at the time?
Well, I think with Murdoch in there, you almost want to say that, I mean, it's possible that once he's done, he becomes an agent or something with the company, you would think. And I would think he would be so much more beneficial to these guys, especially in the heel side, improving their gimmicks or whatever. And I mean, I know Hall was a big mark for him, and as well as a few others. So I mean, I think it would have been very helpful. It probably would have maybe even helped Diesel figure out himself.
See, I think that was one thing that really kind of hurt Diesel, was that he didn't really have anyone to help him get into that mold, like how Baron Corbin's has Kane. He doesn't have that mentor, because the only other big guy you have in the company is Taker, and for the short time, King Kong Bundy. Which is kind of like, what I'm wondering is, you know, you talk about people saying, oh, WCW's got all these old people, but the WWF did too. You know, they had frickin' Nikolai Volkoff in the Million Dollar Corporation.
I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about that for just a fucking second. King Kong Bundy. Now, fuck Nikolai Volkoff and whatever. King Kong Bundy got to have a WrestleMania match in 1995. Against the motherfucking Undertaker.
Yeah.
Why?
I think.
And talk about being out of shape, in terrible shape. How bad was Murdoch if King Kong Bundy could pass a physical and have a match with the Undertaker at Mania?
Really? See, that's another thing. It's like people crapped on WCW because it's like, oh, they got people from the 80s, they got people from, you know, the 70s, all this stuff, and, you know, Vince did the whole, billionaire Ted thing, you know, like we mentioned, Scott Hall mentioned his, anniversary thing you guys talked about. But the thing is, if you look at it, Vince was doing the exact same freaking thing. But he was getting, like, the scrap ends of it. He wasn't getting, the only world champion he got out of the deal from the past was freaking Bob Backlund. And look what they reduced him to in 95.
I'm not going to say that was a WWF thing. I just think that Backlund was legit fucking crazy by that point, and that's what they had to deal with.
Oh, when I was a kid, this is a God honest truth. And if I could go back and tell myself, if I could go back and tell 10-year-old or 8-year-old Stan, that it was going to get worse than this. I was scared when Bob Backlund said he was going to run for president. And if I could have a time machine and go back and tell Stan, 8 years old, look him in the face and say, it's going to be worse than what you think.
Hey, but maybe we'll get a mania at the White House now. Not all is lost.
I'm not surprised at anything anymore.
Well, okay, so we've kind of gone all over the place so far with 95.
What else is new?
That's fucking true. Gary, I know you did a little more research than anybody else did. Anything around closer to the Mania season that sticks out to you on your research?
Other than it was probably the worst Mania of all time. I mean, it was brutal. I think there's probably some other positives later in the year. There was a pretty decent Hakushi Bret Hart match at one of the In Your Houses.
First one.
I was there live for the ladder match at SummerSlam, which was fucking tremendous. Sean almost snapped himself in half on the ladder. That was a great match. But really, those are the only things that really stick out to me that were positive about the product.
You know what, I'll say, I remember as a, probably, maybe, this is probably around 97-98, renting a videotape of WrestleMania 11. And again, not knowing what had happened previously that year. The whole card outside of, the LT Bam Bam Bigelow match, Shawn overselling, the Diesel championship match. I thought, again, another Razor love fest. I thought the best match on that card was Razor versus Jarrett for the Intercontinental title.
Well, Jarrett's a pretty good worker.
Yes.
That was by far the best fucking match of the night. You can't tell me anything even came close to that match.
No.
Jarrett's the type of person, like, you could make him a main eventer. You could probably have put the strap on him a couple times and stuff to fill in if there's a vacancy or something.
Yeah.
But I don't see him being like the face or head of the company like WCW did.
No, you can make the argument that Jarrett had the best match at Rumble, too, that year.
Oh, absolutely.
They had tremendous chemistry.
I just watched that match, or the whole pay-per-view, probably about a month ago. Yeah, and it's amazing to me. And this will be real quick. The microcosm of that year, you look at the best match is probably Razor and Jarrett for Royal Rumble and WrestleMania. And then you got a guy like The Undertaker who just retires this year and how much he's just spinning his wheels in the company. And it's like, you give the belt onto Diesel, but this is probably the guy you probably should hitch your company on if you're not going to hitch it to Bret Hart.
That's why I've always wondered why it took 5 or 6 years for them to put the belt on him again.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, what, his last title run was against Hogan when he, you know, tombstoned him onto the chair at Survivor Series. So he hasn't had a belt since then. You know, so, but yet you're feeding him guys like IRS, Kamala, you know, things like that. I mean, I like the Yoko matches except for when he levitated into the heavens.
That was,
you leave Marty Jannetty alone. That was really funny. Me and Sam went to tell you the same shit at the same time.
I love Jannetty when I was a kid. He was like my favorite wrestler when I was a kid. And then I got to see him Michaels when I was like, well, you know.
But Marty Jannetty was better.
Marty Jannetty is the man, but, you know. Well.
He's who we need on the goddamn podcast. Have y'all ever seen the shit he says? That motherfucker is wild.
Listen, I will buy drugs for Marty Jannetty if he wants to come on here.
What the fuck?
That's a t-shirt if I've ever heard
I mean, if Virgil wants to come on here, I'm only buying him a pack of Newports and giving him a $25 gift card with $8 left on it. For Olive Garden. But
you can
for
see
Olive
the higher,
Garden.
Social hierarchy where these two guys are.
We just ruined Court's career.
But
as soon as this gets really
but
out.
But Marty Jannetty, no, I'll mark out for Marty Jannetty. I'm just saying, I think that, you know, The Undertaker at times does fall into the category of a guy that probably doesn't need a belt, but I feel like, though, in 95, if you're not going to hitch it to Brett, and if Diesel's not working, The Undertaker's probably your best bet, because he's the most, he's the second most over guy in that company, to me.
You know, one thing about 95 is, you know, is that 95, we talked about how they did this with, Diesel, you know, he hot-rodded the whole freaking year just about with the title, and we talked about Rumble, you know, Bulldog almost winning it, and this whole time, like, Bulldog was hot during this year. I mean, 94 going into 95, if they'd done it right, Bulldog could have been that face and took the belt off of, Diesel. Like, do like they did with, like, with Jeff Hardy. You know, chase it for the year, and then he gets that big win.
No, I agree with that. Bulldog was a great heel, but he could have been used as a wonderful babyface. I mean, Bulldog was good, man. You know, and when he could stay clean, even when he wasn't, I mean, shit, he still performed pretty good.
Yeah.
I think you got a lot there. Yeah, David Boy Smith could have really been a top guy. And just like we kind of talked about with Hall, I mean, it was his demons. You know, it was his drug abuse and things like that. I think it really held him down.
I also kind of think he fell victim to the steroid trials, too, because it was clear he was juicing. I mean, it was pretty obvious. He's not a big guy, but, I mean, he was built. So I think, had that steroid trial not happened, I think, yeah, that would have been the logical progression to go with the Bulldog. He was over huge. He was over huge in his first run. He was over huge here. And WCW used him as a main eventer when he had his short run there. So it wasn't out of the question, but I just think he was just so out of place with where they were trying to take the product because of all the steroid bullshit that they had to deal with, that he just kind of was stuck where he was at.
But one thing he did help with was actually he helped bolster the pretty good tag team division that they did have around this time.
I totally agree. I mean, they had some really awful teams. I mean, Smoking Guns was one of their bigger teams, and they were actually planned for a big push around this time, and I guess Vince changed his mind. This again from the sheets, and that push went to the 1-2-3 Kid and Bob Holly, which is a weird tag team, still is. And the reason they gave why the Guns didn't get that push that they were kind of ramping up towards was one of them fell off his horse and got injured. So that was the kind of booking bullshit that was going on in '95. It was pretty embarrassing.
But you talk about how weird 1-2-3 Kid and Bob Holly is. I mean, yeah, the racing gimmick is weird at that time, but I actually think from a worker standpoint, that's a team that works. And outside of that, how do you, I mean, you got Yoko and Owen, but how do you not put, you know, as far as your top heel tag team, how do you not make them the Heavenly Bodies your top heel tag team? These are the guys coming from Smoky Mountain Wrestling. They're clearly the best workers in the company. What the fuck?
To my understanding, they only had a per-shot deal because they were doing that working relationship. It was more or less to get Cornette to come to WWF.
Okay.
Was why they were doing that, and they were doing some cross-promotion because he still wanted to do Smoky Mountain. I think that was kind of the holdup.
Makes sense.
In the same sense, I mean, that would have boosted, even if they did that, that would have helped boost it up a little bit, kind of like a miniature invasion, hype boost and everything. You know, you get your heel team come in there, because, you know, who you have is your top heel team right now? You know, Yoko and Owen. I mean, your top, the previous top heel team was the freaking Quebecers. I mean, you gotta build somebody up. It's not like you can just go to build to Techno Team 2000.
Why not?
They had an awesome theme, and they had an awesome look, but that's about it.
No, they were terrible. I just wanted to stir some shit.
I actually didn't mind the Quebecers. I thought they were pretty good.
Well, the Quebecers were good. I love the Quebecers.
Yeah, Techno Team 2000's who we're shitting on.
Poor Eric Watts.
Oh, fuck Eric Watts.
Well, Chad Fortune actually had done something that nobody in WCW could do until Nash. He actually pinned Goldberg before the streak started.
What?
I think it was on a Saturday night or a Super Worldwide or one of their D shows or something. He pinned Goldberg before he got big.
Yep.
That's awesome. You know, speaking of random fucking Eric Watts knowledge, just because why the fuck not, Eric Watts was randomly placed in one of the best goddamn matches of his career at the 1992 Battle Bowl in WCW. He teamed with Jushin Thunder goddamn Liger against a team of Dr. Dusty, Williams, and Sting. This motherfucker never was even close to lacing any of their tennis shoes, much less their boots, much less being in the fucking ring with any of these professionals.
Who is Dr. Death with? I didn't hear that last part.
It's Sting.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so it's Watts and Liger against Sting and Dr. Death. It's a hell of a fucking match.
Wasn't it because of his daddy?
100% because of his fucking daddy. Piece of shit. Can we shit on Brutus Beefcake any?
Oh, I have some stuff on Beefcake.
I'll bring on the booty, man.
Wait, so, you have a 95 Brutus Beefcake story?
Oh, well, he was in WCW at this point. But they were talking, and again,
Gary,
can you hear me? Oh, sorry.
You went parasailing with the booty man.
Damn
it. I did. There was rumors flying, because they were going to push, Savage had just jumped to WCW, that they were, and Hogan didn't want to drop the title to Savage, but they wanted to put the title on Savage, that there was going to be a transitional champion. Do you guys remember who Hogan wrestled at Starrcade?
Butcher. Oh,
the fucking Butcher, yeah.
They were going to put the title on the Butcher, and then have Savage come in and beat him for the title.
Yeah, because the legacy of a title is being, you know, Flair, Rhodes, Race. That don't mean jack crap when you put it on the frickin' Bruce the Barber.
Sir, They put that goddamn belt on Russo and David Arquette.
Hey, that comes much later.
I don't care. I can belt with Beefcake. Okay?
Okay, in the hindsight, yes. I will deal with Bruce the Zodiac, Booty Man, Beefcake, whatever, compared to frickin' David Arquette. But at least Arquette donated his proceedings to charity.
You calm down, sir. That's my gimmick.
I am calm.
Stealing my shtick, man. That's all I got.
I'll come for one of your tag titles.
God damn it. Don't you wait. Sir. Look, man. I ain't got enough.
You know, you were Gary said something about what were some of the positives for 95. One of the positives I thought for 95 was, maybe I'm wrong, but this is just me looking at it now, was Adam Baum. I really liked Brian Clark as Adam Baum or whatever. But I don't know. I mean, maybe you guys can talk about it more. You know, why is it that he doesn't go anywhere? It just seems like, because, I mean, looking at the King of the Ring right now, the tournament, I mean, he gets pinned by Mabel in under 2 minutes.
He just switched the Earthquake at Mania 10.
Right, and to me, this is a guy that, you know, has the size, he has the look, and I mean, yeah, the gimmick's kind of a little bit hokey, I mean, or whatever, but I don't know, I like the way, I thought he was good.
I think
Becky Lynch makes it work. she essentially stole that gimmick.
True, maybe he should have done the whole duster and everything with it.
Yeah. I don't know if I agree about Adam Baum being a highlight of 1995, maybe for WrestleCrap.
Well, I meant like when you look at 95 and how thin of a roster it is, if I'm gonna choose between Mabel and Adam Baum, I would probably rather have Adam Bomb than fucking Mabel and Rappin' Moe.
I guess, one thing they kind of missed on, and this he went nowhere, and I know he had the, he got arrested for arms charges in 95, and probably drugs too, I'm not for sure, was I think they really missed with Crush and Adam Bomb. I think they if they really knew or something, think, okay, Vince likes big guys, we need some help in the tag division, I think they could have jumpstarted Chronic 5 years early.
They could have. That would actually doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well,
especially once they turned Crush heel and he was doing evil Crush. To me, that would have fit a lot better than where he ended
up. Oh, yeah. Biker Crush, DOA, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, with,
I mean, he's not talking about clowns making kids cry, bro.
Terrible. Have y'all ever heard the, It's an old story that there's no proof of, but apparently in either 93 or 94, Crush came out, it had to be 94 because it was after he turned heel. Crush came out before an episode of Raw in full demolition gimmick to the song, walked around the ring, and exited through the curtain. And the story was, you can look it up and find it. This is a legit, like one of those old urban legends, and it's spread around for years. The rumor is that they were teasing the fans, seeing if there was any interest in a demolition gimmick, like a new version of demolition.
And
Crush ended up getting arrested before they could do anything with it. I don't know if it's true, that's what I've always heard.
To add to that, on another podcast I heard, when Hawk went AWOL after SummerSlam 92 in England, Animal continued out his contract, who did they have get with him to continue the Road Warriors? Crush. So you have Road Warrior Crush. But it's all house shows.
Yeah, I've seen the results for it, but that's awesome. Yeah, because he was, at that point, I think he started being Kona Crush, right?
He started about around late 92, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I thought it kind of went together.
Well, heck, he was getting pushed in 93. He even had a match against Shawn for the Intercontinental, I think, at King of the Ring 93.
Yeah. Because
there were some people that was like, we talked about, they did some things and then they stopped. And I think him and Yoko were the two biggest things that they started and then they just stopped and that was it. And they could have done so much more.
You want to talk about King of the Ring? Let's talk about the shitty-ass 95 King of the Ring.
Oh, yeah.
I will admit, though, and this probably will piggyback again on Gary's best of, at the time I hated Savio Vega.
I still do.
But, you know, I appreciate his work, but how do you make a King of the Ring with Mabel and Savio being your finalists?
I can tell you why, Joe. Glad you brought that up. The plan was for it to be Razor in the finals.
Ah.
But Razor legitimately had a rib injury. That's why Savio had to do 4 matches in one night. He had to win a qualifying match. I think it was on, like, the free-for-all gimmick beforehand, if I'm not mistaken. It wasn't on the actual pay-per-view. But, yeah, Scott Hall had legitimately injured his ribs very shortly before the pay-per-view. One of the rumors is that Razor was actually going to win the whole thing. But when he got hurt, they're like, oh, we'll give it to Mabel. Now, I've also heard that the plan was Mabel the whole time, and that they were going to put him over on Razor to really help his push as a dominant heel. That is why Savio Vega randomly got that big push throughout the tournament. And because Hall even came out with him at the beginning of the night with his ribs all taped up, kind of helping him, but the fans just couldn't get behind Savio.
Right. Yeah, Gary and I used to make fun of Savio Vega all the time as a kid. I'm a legend, you better help me.
You know, sadly, I almost thought that was Bob Dude's theme.
Holy shit. The Black Scorpion's back. I finally hear that ominous music here.
Oh,
production
God.
Value.
Sting.
Yeah, I just totally knocked this off the rails. I'm sorry.
Men on a Mission knocked it off the rails. It's freaking Mabel again screwing everything up like it did King of the Ring and everything. No offense to the recently departed Mabel.
Yeah, but fuck Mo. How about that?
Yeah, fucking screw Mo.
Yeah, that's fine, because, like, after the King of the Ring, then you have In Your House 2, where you got King Mo, King Mabel, Sir Mo, yeah, wrestling Razor and Savio Vega, and they beat them. It's like really?
I would argue that the addition of In Your House in general was a positive for 95. That's when it was introduced. I think it was a good idea. It was, I think, $15 they were marketing it as. That was a hell of a deal at the point in time. That was half of what a normal pay-per-view was. It was a little shorter, but it was still, for those people that are poor like myself, it was a nice thing. I could get a WWE pay-per-view and not feel like I was breaking the bank.
Yeah, I mean, it was 15, and then it jumped up to 20, and still, yeah, when you're paying what, I think, at the time it was 50 for WrestleMania, and then, yeah, 30 or 40 for the other pay-per-views, yeah.
Not only that, it kind of helped go along with this whole thing, like the whole naming scheme, which you'd see in 97, 98, and 99 when they start ending it out and everything. It was like Bad Blood, you know, Beware of Dog, you know, there was actually a theme to it, like, you know, Beware of Dog, here comes the Bulldog's return, or, you know, Bad Blood, you knew there was something in it. And that's something I kind of liked. It was kind of like a an off-brand, kind of like a, I don't know, kind of like a Sam's Club to Pepsi version of Clash of the Champions.
Yeah, I would agree. Do you guys remember the old set, the original set from In Your
yes.
House?
Yes, the actual house.
Yep.
It reminded me of, do you guys ever watch America's Hunt?
Yes.
Yes.
Like the old one? It reminded me of the little, like, fucking living room they had set up in the corner.
Yep.
That's probably where they taped it at. They probably had Bob Saget tied up in the back or something waiting for the auditions when everybody else left.
Bob Saget.
Can't stand that guy.
What's wrong with Bob Saget?
I can't stand him.
Oh, please tell me what's wrong with Bob Saget.
I just never liked him.
There's got to be a reason. Somewhere in your childhood, something got fucked up for you to not like Bob Saget.
My sister watched Full House a lot. That was a good enough reason for me.
I feel like there's more to this.
Sadly enough, I really don't mind him in How I Met Your Mother, though.
Don't make me play the Full House theme song. Because I will. You two get along right now. We will turn this podcast
right. I'm still going for one of his titles.
Look, goddammit, if I'm the one that has stirred shit this time, usually Joe, if he's slacking, he's drinking too much, so I gotta
stir
the pot.
There's been a couple of times where I've had to mute myself, especially when we were talking about replacements for the Road Warriors. I muted myself because it could have came out bad.
But don't be a bitch!
That's why I'm worried.
Listen, I didn't want to make a paralyzed joke just right now. Alright? So,
why not?
I just muted myself, that's all.
What?
You just grew morals?
Yeah, what the fuck has stopped you?
A conscience?
All the shit that I've had to cut out for multiple episodes.
Yeah, Baruch.
This is how I become a guest or something. I come in, and then everything, and the crap goes out the window.
Well, what are the things that I want to discuss about 95. What do you guys feel about the introduction of Sid back into the company? Because I feel like that's kind of been not talked about, because you lose Diesel as Sean's bodyguard, and now you bring in Sid, who eventually will turn on Sean. So now you bring another tall son of a bitch to basically, he challenges Diesel most of the summer or whatever. What do you think about bringing him back?
thought it was pretty good. I was just saying, like, you know, I thought it was a pretty good idea because, you know, Sid, not Sid, Nash has said in the past that, you know, Sid's money, even if he flubs up and stuff, he's still money no matter what he does.
Man, Sid was the fucking best, man. I love me some Sid Vicious.
I may be the odd man out then. I get the look and the appeal of the look. I mean, he was a scary motherfucker. But, I mean, he was horrible in the ring. Like, god awful to watch. I can't recall, maybe you guys can clarify this for me, ever a decent or even good Sid match?
The only one
Keith Slater, because Slater carried him.
Oh, come on.
He had a match with...
Yeah, on Raw a couple of years back.
Yeah.
The only one that really sticks out to me, I'm thinking of the Royal Rumble, 91, was it? Or 91. That was the only thing that sticks out to me as far as Sid. I mean, the rest of them, to me, it seems a little mediocre. I think more WCW matches stick out to me. And that's without the leg break. But I don't know. I mean, I like the idea, and I like the angle that he had with Sean after he left. But, yeah, I'm with you, Gary. I just,
Halloween Havoc 90 match against Sting wasn't bad.
His WCW stuff was fine. I even like his Memphis stuff. I thought Memphis, he was fantastic. It's just like the WWF stuff, I don't know if Vince didn't get in, or if he just didn't care, or what it was, because it just blows my mind that WCW got him right, and Memphis got him right, but WWF,
okay.
Let's see if I can get him right.
Think about this for just a second. I could be in the minority here. Take out your workhorses. So anything in WWF before, like, God, like, 93, 94. How many good matches were there? Let's take out guys like Steamboat. Let's take out guys like Savage. Let's take out Bret Hart. WWF had a style. Yeah.
Or half the tag division.
Well, right. That's where most of the workhorses were, in the Intercontinental or the tag division. WWF had a style, man. So I think that's why, like, a lot of us think of Sid, we think of Psycho Sid. We think of WWF. That's just how WWF was, man. There weren't a lot of good matches. They were a one-trick pony. You come in, the babyface get over, and you leave.
I prefer the Millennial Man over him, over any of them.
Oh, God. Is that when he was trying to beat Goldberg's streak?
Kind of, when he came back to WCW up until he broke his leg.
Yeah, exactly. Gary, who? That was correct.
I must have checked out at that point. I did not.
Because he had, was it Slick Johnson was his referee, and he would just all of a sudden have like 20 new victories by the time next week's episode of Nitro hit. It was terrible.
Yeah.
Was that like 2000?
Yeah, 99 or 2000, yeah.
Okay. That was another case of, like, they would have been the backwards of what we talked about earlier about WWF being the workhorse and everything and having the talent. They were doing the backwards version at the end of WCW. They had a lot of talent, but they didn't know what the hell they were doing.
So, let's talk about talent in WWF in 95 for a second. And one of WWF's rare occurrences where they let one of their wrestlers work for another promotion, the 1-2-3 Kid was granted permission to go to Japan and wrestle in a juniors tournament, which I believe was for Michinoku Pro. So that's kind of wild, even for them.
That sounds
about right.
They seem to be doing a lot of that around that time, though. They had the working relationship with Smoky Mountain. I think, weren't they doing stuff with the USWA during that period of time?
That's where Waller came. There was a thing also, Vince Memphis or something, and it was like, and that was it. It was like Vince would bring up Lawler, and he'd be a heel in the WWF, but down in Memphis, Lawler was a face, and Vince was the heel. Then they reversed the roles back and forth, and Vince was threatening to bring down Brett and all these other people.
I'll admit, like, as a kid, I didn't like the 1-2-3 Kid, mainly because he always was challenging Razor or whatever, and I thought, Why you piece of shit? I don't fucking like him. He looks like a dork. But he's a fucking hell of a worker at 95. Like, looking back, like, holy shit, like, why isn't this guy getting, you know, a bigger push? I mean, I know he's small, but I mean, he was doing stuff that, you know, at the time, given what was on TV, I'd never seen really before going on.
Waltman actually had a title match against Brett on Raw, I believe in 94.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty fucking awesome. And it was like a throw together thing, but they let them have it. And it was like, that should have shown them that good matches could have brought them a different crowd because they had lost all these stars to WCW. And it took them a little while to realize they didn't need stars, they just needed quality matches.
That's when they started doing this. Well, this is a new generation, you know.
Yeah, the new generation. Let's start with the new generation. When they take one of ECW's hottest stars and turn him into a school teacher.
Ah, Dean Douglas.
I'm in the minority here. I fucking love Dean Douglas. I think that character could have went places. But because I love Shane Douglas. He's one of my all-time favorites.
Same here.
Cheap plug, but I got to team with him last weekend. The fact that Douglas is a little bit of a hothead. He likes to stir his shit. That's just his deal. I don't know if it was his fault. I don't know if it was the clique's fault. You have differing stories here. But I really feel like had he not had all that heat with the clique, that Dean Douglas could have actually done something. People shit on the gimmick, but it got him heat. As a kid, I fucking hated when he was scratched a fucking chalkboard. He was like, to me, he was a top heel.
Yeah, I mean, we're a year removed from the NWA tournament where he, you know, cuts that, you know, that kick-ass promo for ECW. I mean, yeah, theoretically, he should be one of your top heels. Because, that sticks out to me. And I think he's a hell of a worker. But
I think it was both sides of the coin. I think it wasn't so much once the clique, if it wasn't so much Douglas, but I think it was just a clash of oil and water.
I mean, it's possible. I mean, I know that there was, I mean, you hear all the stories, especially from Shane or the clique or whatever, whether it's front office or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I agree that the character and stuff, probably give it some more time, it probably does get over. And I mean, you look at it, like we talked about Steve Austin earlier, you can eventually get away from that gimmick. As long as you continue to get over. So even if that's just his foot in the door, I think that if he continues, he probably can get over and then get away from that and be his own thing. And probably would have done well for himself.
A proper Douglas Michaels match would have been great.
Oh my God, yes. And also, let's talk about guys that could have gotten over a little bit better. And I'm going to go ahead and blame my future wife for this. Chris Candido.
Yes.
Had gotten fucking just the best push. But Sonny, and I love you, honey, fuck that up. Like, if Sonny, she had her deal with Michaels and you, whatever the other stories are, that she was with whoever and whatever.
Well, but I think, they have some sunny days.
Well, I think that because of whatever was going on with Sonny, got Chris a lot of unnecessary heat. The Bobby Donovan's gimmick was over. Sonny and Skip was fucking awesome. Then they added in Tom Pritchard, and poor guy had to cut his hair off. I watched a shoot interview one time with Chris Candido, and so they told him, you were going to get a new partner. And he said, oh, who? Oh, it's going to be Tom Pritchard. And he was super excited. He goes, yeah, we're going to make Tom Pritchard shave his head and look like you. And he said he was definitely afraid. They made him go to the barbershop with Tom Pritchard, and he said they never lost eye contact. Tom just stared at him, and he was like, that's it, he's going to fucking kill me in my sleep. They did at least get a tag title run out of it, which was nice.
They got at least more than one.
And Sonny got a couple tag runs out of WWF, too.
He said that, not me, Sonny. I still love you.
Wait,
this is important. Guys, if anybody wants to give me any money on PayPal, I'll send you the link. I gotta talk to Sonny. We gotta make this happen, guys, okay? This is very important.
I mean, yeah, I didn't mind the Body Donna's gimmick. I question, though, their use of Sonny to a point, because I don't know, you look at her in Smoky Mountain, and she's basically doing a Hillary Clinton gimmick, and getting tons of heat, and then you bring her here now, I mean, I didn't absolutely hate her, but then again, I was a kid going through puberty at this time, so, what I'm saying is I really wish I would have seen WWF give her a little bit more, looking back on it now.
One thing about Sonny that I will be mad at her about is that she agreed to turn on the Body Donalds and go to Smoking Guns. And that killed poor Chris Candido's career in the WWF.
Well, one of the other big, like people to come into the company was Dustin Rhodes. He obviously comes in as Goldust. I don't know. I like Dustin Rhodes, and I think he's a highlight of 95. Obviously, he gets, catches on, as the years, couple years go on, but he's one of the highlights that stick out to me.
I would have really been interested to see where that character would have progressed to had it not got so much backlash and had the time to kind of grow. Because, I mean, it was really doing some racy stuff for 95 and 96 and the angle with Razor and the angle with Piper and all those things and really pushing the envelope. I think it would have been interesting to see how that would have went, and not the Baby New Year bullshit that he was doing. That was really
well. What's funny is you see what, or you read in like the Observer and stuff, like, and I've heard in different interviews where they had him squaring off against Shawn Michaels and some house shows, and just the heat that he was getting from fans, and they kind of pulled it back a little bit. Maybe for safety reasons or whatever. I mean, this is the guy that you probably should be, be one of your top heels, if that's the case. Given the climate of today's society, I mean, this is a guy that you want legit heat from. That should be your top heel.
What would have been awesome is had we gotten any of those ladder matches in 96 on television. Because Goldust had a series of ladder matches with Shawn Michaels in 96. And there's footage on like Daily Motion and YouTube of people who snuck in camcorders. Man, he had the casket match with Taker and stuff like that. But had you let Goldust have a ladder match on television, I think it would have helped his career so much more. But they were so worried about pushing the envelope, at this point, that that's why they kind of took that step back and they ended up turning babyface and doing all this stuff with him. Man, there's no reason that Goldust couldn't have been the WWF champion.
No, I don't see a reason.
I would have liked to have seen an actual gold version of the world title like he did with the Intercontinental when he was feuding with Ahmed Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that would have been pretty sweet with the wings. Oh, yeah. And everything.
Dustin probably go down as big of a name as his daddy, but he had that work talent to help bridge between his daddy and his younger brother. I mean, that's not a shot at either one of them or him. I mean, Dustin in 95, 96 was amazing.
Well, I mean, to me, like, when you look at Dusty, like, as when Dusty was younger, I think he was a better worker when he was younger. I think as the later years got on, it was more of his charisma that really helped him. I mean, he could work and still go, but not to that level.
Same with Hogan. It was just his charisma and his name value.
Right. But I think when you look at his kids, whether it's Dustin or Cody, I think they have it all. And I mean, there's really not even a drop off. I went to a SmackDown show with Gary and saw Stardust and Goldust. I mean, Goldust, like, he could still go. Like, he's still a hell of a talent. And the fact that the highest he's ever gotten is an Intercontinental title is just, it's blasphemy to me.
Yeah. I mean, he's like, what, 40? He's not many years away from Taker, and he's still going active. I mean, at the age he's at now, Taker was actually scaling back to once a year. But, you know, mind you, he has had the injuries that Taker's had, but still.
Can you imagine a proper Gold Dust Undertaker feud? I mean, that really, the only kind of feud they had was just a segue into Taker and Mankind.
Right.
It would have been so much better, I think. I mean, there's so much. I mean, I play a fantasy booker again, but you can go back and look at so much that Gold Dust could have done and should have done. And they just were afraid to push the envelope so much. You know, which I can't blame them. I mean, they were kind of losing at that point, losing their ass. So you don't want to do anything to piss off the masses. You know, homosexuality was not as widely, what's the word I'm looking for? Accepted. You know, homosexuality wasn't accepted back in 95 the way it is, you know, now 20 years later. So you see that and you're like, oh, we don't want all this bad publicity. Let's take it back. He can still be kind of flamboyant, but not full-fledged homosexual like he was being. You know, when he kissed Ahmed Johnson and left the lipstick all over him and, you know, wearing the lingerie at WrestleMania 12. You know, yeah, it was really racy. Not half as racy as what they would do a few years later. But it's a shame that they wanted to step back like that. But at the same time, they had to.
I'm not saying that they shouldn't have stepped back. I think that, you know, you put that same gimmick in maybe WCW, and I think Bischoff is willing to go balls to the wall, no pun intended, with the gimmick. It just, I think at times Vince shouldn't play it safe to play it safe, because, I mean, what's any different than Shawn Michaels going out there and acting like a male gigolo? I mean, the only thing he's not doing is kissing the guy. I mean, he's pretty much doing the same thing. He's going out there and stripping down in front of young children. But,
hell, look at Adrian Adonis in 87.
Right, yeah. You know, I mean, Adrian, him, or even, like, you look at Adrian Street in Memphis. I mean, you know, he was definitely getting freaking heat back then because nobody knew what he was. He was androgynous, too. But I don't know, I just feel like when you're so weak with heels at this point in 95, god damn, just push Goldust or something, because you got nothing. All the other heels people have already seen are tired of seeing.
They had King Mabel.
My question, I'm wondering.
Just write King Mabel off.
Can we talk about how Mabel tries to murder both Diesel and The Undertaker before his run is finally cut short?
Sure, why not?
I mean, crush two of your biggest baby faces of that era, and then they're finally like, alright, get the fuck out of here.
What else was he gonna do? He was like 900 pounds. The only thing he could probably do well was crush things.
There's a guy, guy with that name anyways.
You know who got the shit into the stick when Mabel got that push?
Oscar.
It was motherfucking Oscar.
Yeah, Oscar got cut to the side.
Fucking Oscar was the only reason they really even got signed. And then they turned Mabel heel, and they're like, ah, fuck Oscar.
Go preach somewhere else. Like, come on, man. Oscar was the fucking backbone of Men on a Mission. Pieces of shit.
You know, I'm wondering if that, back to Goldust and everything, I'm wondering, because I heard somewhere that when Johnny B. Badd jumped ship to the WWF, I wonder if that's what really Vince wanted something to do, was kind of like an antagonist to Goldust to try to get the Johnny B. Badd character, kind of like a contradiction to him.
I can't believe, I cannot fucking believe we just brought Johnny B. Badd back up.
I know, this episode is going to be 12 hours long now. Court is drunk, and he's going to talk about Johnny B.
Well, I didn't mean to. I was trying to make him stay more in depth. I was like, you know what? Okay, here's another good thing that happened in 95. Triple H.
No, hold on. No, stop. Just wait. Let me get this out of my system. I've had to review Johnny B. Badd in 95, okay? Then, on the other podcast, I had to review the debut of Johnny B. Badd in 91. And I'm soon going to have to fucking review Johnny B. Badd in 94. So I thought, in WWF in 95, and there's no sign of Mark Marrow anywhere, I was safe. But no, you bring this shit back up to haunt me. Not for nothing, though. I'll give him a little bit of credit. Johnny B. Badd, the actual character Johnny B. Badd in Goldust Feud, probably been a lot of fun.
Before, I know Stan wants to talk about Triple H being the one positive, but continue on the bad. Can we talk about how bad Ahmed Johnson's going to be? WWE.
Great googly googly.
His promo.
When I was a kid, I saw Ahmed Johnson. The only thing that didn't stick out to me was his finisher. That was it.
Well, that and thigh pads, or thigh whatever those fucking things are.
He was so fucking protected. He had pants and all kinds of protective gear all over the place, man.
Yeah, and then you got him, like, eventually beating Ron Simmons with an egg carton on his head, and it's like, ugh.
But this is the man who beat Vader for a title, and you're doing this to him.
They don't give a shit. Look what they did to Vader.
Yeah, unfortunately. You talk about your heels of the company, there you go.
I cannot believe we're on here for
Well, the funny thing is, we haven't even talked about Mantar, Quang, the Brooklyn Brawler wearing a baseball face paint, and all that, Aldo Montoya and all that stuff.
Hey, you I mentioned Aldo bitch. Montoya at the beginning.
Well,
Brad Radford.
Yeah, it was the other one, yeah.
Man Mountain.
Well, we didn't talk about him because, you know, he's still passed out at the McDonald's in California. But no, as far as Ahmed Johnson goes, like, as a kid, yeah, the look, I got the look. I mean, he's a big guy, got a great physique, cool ass finisher, but then you put a mic in front of his face and,
it's like listening to Lesnar.
I don't know what it's like. I'd rather somebody back over my head with a car tire or something. I don't know.
He sounds like Boomhauer from King of the Hill.
That's like a picture now. I'm never going to get there on this podcast again. I think I just killed myself in a second chance.
No, this thing fucking derailed months ago.
We've only been doing it a month.
Damn. we switched from Ahmed Johnson. I'll try to help out.
About time. Only took you 5 minutes.
Well, I've been over here looking at eyebrows.
Hey. Sir, oh wait, time out, sir. At least he was here for every episode.
True that. I didn't have the drizzling shits, much like 95.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we couldn't hear him through through all that second episode because of
well,
the
at least the Click,
which is really our first special,
the Click fan special appearance. if you look at 95, this I mean, all of the 80s.
Is that what we've been doing for
2 years? All of the 80s, you had this. But in 95, it was starting to be more apparent that you have these bad fucking gimmicks. You got Duke the Drumster Rosie, you got Henry O. Godwin, then you got Mantar, and Aldo Montoya. Like, why? Why in 95 are you going to the shit? And it's only going to lead up to, you know, the plumber, the hockey player, and everything else.
And Man Mountain Rock was initially supposed to be a blacksmith. So he wasn't even supposed to do his rock and roll gimmick, which he was doing at WCW before. He was going to be another stupid job that they were doing. It was like the blue-collar worker tour. They had everyone on there had some sort of union job.
Apparently. I don't get it because you're ruining a guy like Tony Anthony as the plumber. You're ruining, I mean, just incredible as Aldo Montoya. And we haven't even scratched the fucking surface with Cross Colors Fatu.
Hey, and, make a difference.
It's make a difference.
Would make a fucking difference if we just ended it right now. But
I agree.
It's just, it's so bad. I don't get it. I mean, the only legitimate thing I would give is Double J with his country music gimmick. Other than that, I mean, it's just, it's so bad.
We didn't fucking touch SummerSlam yet. We didn't touch Survivor Series yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, we touched SummerSlam that first episode, and don't get me started on the fucking Attitude Era. I'll burn this motherfucker down.
Yeah, now, see, I think that's where me and Joe will get along great, because I fucking hate the Attitude Era. Like, I loved it, but I hate all of it.
Looking at, Gore talked about Survivor Series 95, I was glad to see it was presented by Karate Fighters. I think I had a thing of those.
Wait, I just recently, in the past couple of months, found all of mine from my childhood.
So there you go.
So Court was the only one that
I got it for Christmas.
Well, no wonder! Court sponsored this pay-per-view. That's how bad it is.
Hey, sir, number one, fuck you. Number two, they are hours of fun.
How is it, in 95, how is a dark match for Survivor Series of Smoking Guns versus the Public Enemy? How does Public Enemy this time not at least the first fucking matchup when you have a fantastic fucking lineup of just shit fucking Survivor Series matchups?
Yeah.
That's how they
booked it, Joe. I mean, goddamn. I mean, well, I'm just saying, like, you have the dark side, which is Taker, Vega, Fatu, and Henry O. Godwin, versus Lawler, Mabel, and Yankum, and Hunter. I would much rather watch fucking the Guns and Public Enemy. Like, goddamn.
Wasn't this also about the same time when, Bruce to start booking?
Who knows?
That explains it right there.
It is.
Wait, it is?
Yeah.
That early?
Yep.
Holy shit.
It was him, Pat, Jim Ross, and Vince.
That's wild.
I mean, what also boggles my mind is you have a 4-on-4 elimination matchup with the women. Like, I didn't even know that there was 8 women in fucking WWE at this time.
There couldn't have been. Was it a lot of Japanese girls or something?
Yeah, it was Bertha Faye, Asia Kong, Lioness Asuka, with, and Harvey Whippleman with Alundra Blaze, and then, there was also, Tomoko Watanabe, and then there was Alundra Blaze, Coco Inu.
Beware.
Whatever these Asian names I cannot pronounce right now, but yes.
I was going to say, I hope we have a podcast of Joey just trying to pronounce
Japanese. you lost me at Hakushi, alright?
Okay, so if we get guys like Toyota Suzuki, you'll be okay.
I'll be alright, okay? I'll be okay with that, or Taka Michinoku, but then I draw the line at that.
That's essentially the whole women's division of the WWF in 94-95. It's all women that got...
It wasn't women's division. It was just whoever...
It was all who they could pick up from all Japan.
Bull Nakano was bringing.
Well, yeah. the funny thing is, you listen to Alundra Blaze on, I think it was Cornette's podcast... She said 95% of the women that were coming into the WWF was based on her booking. She was the one telling Vince, this is who you need to bring in. So apparently Vince didn't even fucking know, or fucking care. But he wanted to have a women's division.
Well, that's true. That's still not that bad. People, because why is Asuka not that bad, you know? Bull Nanako wasn't bad. You know, Burst of Fate could be used as a monster. You know, you can't get Reggie Bennett, so use Bertha Fay. But there wasn't... It's just weird. It's kind of like the opposite of like what you see like with the European title. You see a lot of people outside of Europe holding it, but nobody from Europe holding it. And that's kind of like a... Kind of, sort of, the opposite of what they do with their women's division.
'95 sucked.
The end.
I mean,
if I ever get a second chance at this, I swear I'll pick a better topic.
No, this is a good topic. We've talked for almost 3 hours.
I can see why the
40 minutes of fucking content out of this fucking episode.
I think we got a lot in there. I can see why
these guys did somas back in the day.
I'm doing somas right now.
Hey, Sonny.
I'm having a lot of sunny days.
Yeah, I could go for paint. I could go for something for my neck and back. I got some candy here. I got Mike and Vike.
Somebody needs to pass that Bolivian booger sugar or something.
What?
Joey has insulted black people, Asians, and Hispanic people in the span of 5 episodes.
How did all of those in one fucking episode just now?
How have I insulted the Asian people? I have not said anything. Listen, I never...
By butchering their names.
Okay, yes, but
he just did it to the Japanese. He didn't say anything bad about anybody from Singapore or Thailand.
I never once... I'll just stop myself there. I never want...
Come on, Joey.
No. I'm going there.
Do it, you pussy.
You've already been there. So just stay there.
Oh, come on.
I was never going to say that I remember Gary's dad telling us that Hakushi looked like he rolled around on the Japanese newspaper. I never said that.
I shouldn't laugh at that. I shouldn't, but...
I like it.
You should.
Gary's dad sounds like my grandpa. Like, it makes a lot of sense.
Or he referred to the cruiserweights as Mexican jumping beans. That was another one of his favorites.
Do
you remember Alex Wright's nickname was Das Wonder Kid? My grandpa fucking hated Alex Wright for some reason. So every time he came on TV, he was Das Wonder Shit.
It's probably because of the
jerk. Did he like him when he was a Nazi?
Oh, I forgot about the Nazi gimmick.
He gave up on WCW by then. We were just watching WWF.
I actually like the Berlin gimmick. I don't know why.
How did we end up on... We were supposed to talk about 95 WWF, and 3 hours later we're talking about Berlin. How the fuck did that happen?
It spans half a decade. It covers everything like a poisonous crap.
We are so far off topic. I don't even care because it's entertaining, but fuck. That's what we should do. That should be our gimmick for our podcast, is we should just put, like, oh, we're going to talk about 96 WWF, and then just talk about something completely different that has nothing to do with anything that we said we were going to talk about.
Well, is there anything else we can think of for 95, or do you want to...
Well, when we do part two, we can start covering 95 WWF.
Okay? Belligerent motherfuckers in this group. Well, I mean, we can definitely, I know down the road, continue on about these pay-per-views, because obviously we don't have enough time or probably enough energy to talk about them in depth.
Patience.
Or that, too. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, 95 is... It's funny to see. You look at 95, and it's not a great year, but then 96, 97, they fucking turn the thing around, so. It's definitely not where I would have seen the company at that point.
You know who did have a good 95, though? Was ECW.
Me. I had a good 95.
What did you do?
I was 11. Life was looking up in 95. I was 11 years old. I had my whole life in front of me. Little did I know I would end up here wasting 3 hours talking about 1995 WWF, sort of half drunk and depressed and contemplating my life choices over the last 20 plus years.
Sonny, you had a good 95 people.
Alright, let's
wrap it up. Well, let's just wrap it up. I'll help wrap it up. Well, one thing we can look forward to, hopefully, I mean, it's a fluid situation, but as we wrap up here, the next episode we plan on talking about, at least, is retro pro wrestling games. We're going to start with the 8-bit era in the 80s and 90s, and then slide into the 16-bit era with Sega and Super Nintendo. That should be an interesting topic, one that we could probably talk about in depth.
I'm excited about that, honestly. That's past, like, Sega Genesis, dude, I'm out of games, really. So that's my shit, so I'm super excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, I know that for a lot of our listeners and a lot of people in our group, you know, we're roughly about the same age, so this should all be stuff that we experienced when we were growing up. So I look forward to that. Also, too, the downloads have been pretty good. I know Quartz got a show up with his buddy that he can talk about a little bit. I listened to it, liked it a lot. So, Quartz, if you want to talk about it a little bit, go ahead.
Yeah, where we kind of just have fun, occasionally get kind of drunk and shit on things. Classic Wrestling Review is a little more serious. Every week we'll pick a different pay-per-view. We don't know who's gonna pick what. And, me and my buddy Terry are big old school wrestling fans. So the idea is that we're not gonna do anything past around the 90s is the latest we'll do. So, the first episode we've got up, which if you haven't checked it out, please go check it out. We, did a review of Super Raw 1. The next time we put one up, which hopefully will be sometime in the next week or so, will be Spring Stampede 1994. And just, we're going through the 80s and the 90s and just kind of reviewing, telling some backstories, telling you what led up to it, just kind of almost like a history lesson in wrestling. And it's a little more serious, you know, it's, if you want to learn anything about an era of wrestling that you don't know about, or if you just want to, if that's your era of wrestling you enjoy and you want to hear more about it, come check us out. Where Ringside Chat is a weekly podcast, Classic Wrestling Review is probably going to be a bi-weekly podcast unless something changes.
So, again, for everyone, follow us on Facebook at Ringside Chat. Then there's a Twitter, Ringside Chat Pod at Ringside Pod. Also, go on Podbeam. We're there. You know, please. We got over 300, we've got around 300 some followers, and, you know, we post at other different Facebook groups stuff. You know, even if you don't listen, just download it, give us some feedback, whatever. Make sure to continue to support Court and his cheese issue that he's got going on right now.
I need that cheddar.
If
you talk to Sonny some more, you're gonna have a lot of cheese.
If you, we appreciate the feedback. We appreciate all the members here, including Stan, who have really helped make this Facebook group, really what it is. And with all the traffic and the positive comments and the contributions. So just everyone, just keep it up, and, you know, we'll stop this whenever you guys still want it or when we don't feel like doing it ever again. So that's all I got. I don't know about you guys.
Stan, you got anything to plug?
I got an art site that I have, art page, the art of Stan Sharp, but that's nothing really big. It's just my drawings.
Yeah, go check those out. If you're listening, the three people that are listening, go to Stan's Facebook group and look at his art. His art's pretty good.
There might be 105 people watching, so I'll take that as a win.
There we go. And check out Stan's TEW results that he posts in Ringside Chat. They're always entertaining and fun to check out.
I got
out.
One coming up soon. I think I got Survivor Series 2003.
All right, so next week, thanks to Stan for coming. Next week, we're going to do the retro video game episode, part one. And for Court and Joe and Stan, that's it. See you later.
See you. Later.